beauty, nature, spirit, sustainability. These words welcome you to our guest's website, itself a sacred space. And after my conversation with her this week, they almost say it all about her, but let me provide a bit more background. Elizabeth Murray is an author, artist, and speaker. She spent 25 years restoring and photographing Claude Monet's gardens in Giverny, France. And through that experience, she has gained deeper insights and inspirations regarding beauty. Through her work and now new books, she shares those insights and inspirations with others. As she says, "I feel sacredness and beauty, and even say a prayer before I photograph something, that it will open people's hearts. I believe there is a healing vibration in beauty." So let's try and create some sacred space on Service Space right now, and welcome Elizabeth Murray.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me to speak on your wonderful service call. I feel very honored. And I think you already have sacred space. I mean, everyone who joins and the whole intention and the whole vibration of the idea is all about connecting, you know, like the forest connects with all the root system and all around the world. So thank you for including me.
Well, thank you for being here. Elizabeth, tell us how you first encountered your passion and what enabled you to live it so thoroughly.
Excuse me, first encountered what?
Your passion.
Oh, my passion. Well, I think it's that I never left it since childhood. I think my original passion has always been with nature. I would say nature, spirit, and creativity. And that's been since childhood. And I think for me, nature is where I find a lot of my spirit connection and find the ultimate of creativity. And so I have a really open, since childhood, I have a very open relationship with the mystery or God or the great spirit, whatever you want to call that force that's in everything and all over. And it's all about creativity. So I just always have done something. And so through that, gardening is one of the ways that I have discovered that I can play with natural elements and kind of be a partner with nature to create like a sacred space or a place of great artistic expression and work with seasons and time and plants and place and stone and soil. And so that's one of the elements. But I think I've always had that passion, and then I've always kept it, and it's always nurtured me. And through, even as a teenager with difficulties with a childhood, my mother was ill since I was 10 with cancer, and we had many different difficulties growing up. But I think that nature and that sense of spirit was always sustaining for me.
That's wonderful. So it sounds like for you, it's almost as if your passion found you, and it wasn't so much a precipitating event.
I don't know. I think it's just keeping your love, you know, keeping your love, and it's relationship. And I think sometimes people. Well, I feel like relationship can be with the unseen world, you know, like spirit world or the world of inspiration or the world of beauty, or you know, it doesn't have to be something that's tangible.
So for you then, it sounds like you're so open that it led your passion for beauty and finding the spirituality in beauty. Led you into gardening, which took you to France for 25 years, it sounds like, where not only were you gardening, you were also photographing these gorgeous, gorgeous acres and acres of gardens by Claude Monet. And in addition to the photographing, you're also an artist. I was on your website and I saw your paintings. You paint in different styles and different mediums. Was there a straight path to that, or like a garden, did things just kind of come up for you, and did you simply follow an inclination to explore different expressions of art and beauty?
Yeah, I think it's always one thing leads to another. But my love of, I used to teach nature to children and teach environmental education, and I started full-time gardening when I was 18, and I left California to move to Maine to live off the land, and then in college I was environmental studies and art and botany, and just always bringing those together and using art as a way of getting more expressing the beauty, or I did it also for having people understand what marshes were or different environments through through art, photography, painting, a little bit of writing, and then different ways of educating or different ways of inspiring people. I love writing, but it's everything is, takes a challenge. It takes a lot more time than you think and a lot more work than you think. But it's a wonderful way to share and open. And so then the last 25 years or so, I've gotten into writing. And I was led to Monet's garden by taking some, I had 9 people working for me as gardeners here in the Monterey Peninsula, and had gotten into horticultural therapy and using gardens as a way of for therapy if you were physically, had physical problems or mental, emotional problems, taught people with that. And then I went there and just fell in love with that garden and thought, well, I'll quit my job and I'll move here and I'll help work in the garden so I could know it well. And I only worked there the 1 year in 85 and then got invited to return every year to photograph it. And then those photographs have been made into calendars and books and big shows with Monet's paintings. Last year we had a wonderful one at New York Botanical Garden that was 370,000 people got to visit, and they recreated Monet's gardens. So for me, with Monet's garden has been this gift of inspiration and leading with beauty and creating. It's different than the kind of sacred space that I've visited in Japan or in Bali or other parts of the world. It's a place of organized beauty that really has a vibration that it was certainly inspired Monet to heal himself as well as to make these beautiful paintings that still have resonance. So that's, Monet's garden has been a big part of my life, and photographing it has been an honor and privilege, and I lecture about it and write about it, and it has, deeply influenced and inspired me.
That's great. I have another quote of yours. Perfection holds us back. Imperfection allows us to play and take risks and be real. And it sounds like beauty and the creation and savoring of it are not dependent on some sense of rightness. So what does beauty mean to you, and how can we perhaps expand our ideas of beauty?
Well, to me, I think beauty is a reflection of the sacred, actually. I think it's an expression from the divine that kind of connects us to heart and makes us go, ah, And it's like when the astronauts got to look back on Earth, and all of a sudden they were like just completely awed at the beauty and the fragileness of our Earth and really getting that we were in space. It's when you see this beautiful flower and or wildflowers, and it's just a gift. And I think, and if we have the ability to, even in our simple ways, to create beauty around our home or in the way we dress, and I don't mean in artificial, a bunch of expensive stuff that you buy, but just in order and things that are thoughtful. I think it's about intentionality. But I think it's, for me, I think sometimes beauty has been trivialized and it's become something of like a cosmetic industry, but it's not really. I think we can take it back and realize that it's something that can open our hearts and I would say connect us to the mystery, connect us to something that is universal and is really like a message. This is really beauty from nature, beauty. But then as a human, we can create just in simple ways. And the reason I say to let go of perfection, and when I teach my classes, I see how we can all hold ourselves back, you know, because we don't think we're good enough. And certainly, like, if I'm painting on the cliffs in Big Sur, looking at this incredible ocean and trying to paint that, there's no way I can compare. So if I can just bring that beauty into my heart and then let it come out of my hands, then the best I can do is to create a moment in my painting that will be like a vibration of that beauty and like a reflection of it. And I think that if we can let go of our holding of perfection, then something beyond what we could ever think of can come through us. And that's where play and experimentation and curiosity come in. It's like a process.
Can you perhaps share with us an experience of painting something that provided a transformative moment for you?
Well, sometimes I paint. Sometimes I paint and I listen to really beautiful music or inspiring. I love John O'Donohue, his poetry and his writing. Sometimes I listen to that. Sometimes I will be in the middle of a painting and I will feel like it's not going well. And sometimes I can get myself discouraged thinking, oh, gosh, you've lost it. You can't do this anymore. You know, that voice comes up and then you go. And then just like turning around, closing my eyes, breathing, and going back into heart-centered love, and all of a sudden inviting in inspiration, or sometimes even saying a prayer, so that I get reconnected to the process and start to fall in love with the color or with the shapes, or to see it anew and see it. And it depends on the painting, and if I'm painting, sometimes I paint from the inside out, which is inspiration from inside myself, like wild gardens that come from within, or sometimes it's in place, you know, like the cliffs of Big Sur where you're seeing this incredible wild beauty. So there are different approaches, and sometimes I might paint because it is my gift to myself. It's not to give to anybody else. It's my joyfulness. And just recently, a week ago, I was in the Galapagos Islands in the jungle and in Ecuador, which I love. And I was just making these wonderful sketches and watercoloring them, you know, in the wild. And those have a different kind of beauty and different kind of wildness. And it's something that imprints, even though I love my photography, the painting, taking time to paint, helps you really see, and yeah. It's a different connection. So I think there's different approaches. But a lot of times when I make a painting, I might have an idea ahead of time, and then the painting has a life of its own, and it starts to speak on its own. And then what I need to do is to respect it. It's kind of like raising a child, that you wish your child would be grow up a certain way or something, but you really respect that spirit. So I think sometimes with good paintings, they have a certain spirit, and you don't control them the whole time. You let that emerge, and as that emerges, then you're in the creative, juicy process, and you're just helping it. And then those kind of paintings I feel really good about. I look at them at night. I put them by my bed, and I look at them, and I go, oh, my God. I mean, they're like standing on their own. They're not my work. They are... And they've been come through me. And I think the best of my work, whether it's the best writing or photography or painting or even speaking, it's when it comes through you and it's beyond you, and it's not about your control or about what you pre-thought. And then sometimes I look at these kind of paintings and I go, you know, who came today? Who am I meeting? Who? What part of me is there today? And so that's the part that can only come if we're kind of like out of control, you know, not controlling everything.
Out of
because
our head. Yeah.
Someone else, something else, some greater spirit can come through. And sometimes it takes great practice and discipline just to get to that opening, you know, and it's a trusting. It's a deep trusting. But right now I'm in the middle of writing a new book, and some of my writing I read and I go, gosh, that was really good. Where did that come from? Oh, my gosh. You know, I go, that was really inspired. And then others, I still have to write a bunch more, and I just pray and I just go, oh, please, you know, work with me, work with me. You know, I can't do this on my own. Help me out here, you know. And it's really a privilege to be, you speak a lot of service. And I think sometimes at, you know, when we are artists, the best of our work, at least for myself, is of service to the mystery. So you put yourself in a kind of a humble position of asking for, to use your skills to do the best writing or to bring the messages that need to be brought out at this time or to create a painting that could create a vibration like Monet's that actually heal or actually inspire or calm the nerves of the people who see them. So I think that kind of partnership or create a garden that creates a sense of the sacred or creates a healing force or like that. I think that's the best. We don't get it all the time. It just happens, you know, but you have to sort of be like an athlete that you're ready for that good game or something.
Yeah, that's just a great way of looking at it. Perfection, I think, is probably a creature of our left brain, and so the imperfection is that wild side where God expresses through us. I'm so pleased that you mentioned the new book you're working on. It's called Living Life in Full Bloom, and the way you described it to me, it made it sound like the culmination of a new and maybe a deeper understanding you have reached over the past several years. Would you share with us what the book is about and how you came to write it?
Yeah, I'd be pleased. Well, I've been teaching a method called life mapping, and it's about it's a process of really figuring out what your passions are and then what your gifts and talents are and then what you feel the world needs. And then you combine those and you kind of make an action plan, and then you create, in the center, you create what is your North Star that's going to keep you focused and in balance in your life, financially, physically, emotionally, and so on. So I've been working on that with my friend, and then I've been teaching it. And really asking my guidance, what is the best contribution I can give? What is the best thing I can give right now? And so my guidance was to write this book. And then I really needed to have more guidance of specificity of, okay, how am I going to do this and exactly what it is? And so what came to me was to write it with four archetypes or pathways. And these are ones that are completely dear to me and I hope are universal. So the first pathway is the gardener, which is really intimacy with nature. And as you know, but I know the modest garden gate, but I also love nature. I love the wild. So each one of these archetypes has 30 different practices, maybe awe and wonder or night skies or weather or different things that will bring you into that part of nature. And then there's the artist, which is imagination and creativity, and the lover, to lead with the heart, and what we love, we protect, we commit to. And then the last one is spirit weaver, which is about celebration and ceremony and ritual or prayer or meditation to create that sacred space, to bring in practices of, you know, everything from gratitude to presence or mindfulness or generosity or service. So that's part of it. That's a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm telling stories about 7 different friends of mine, completely different, that live in full bloom, that combine these 4 things in different ways and how they reach out to the bigger world with that. And then I'll share that life mapping process, and then there'll be some resources. And I will certainly, I'm certainly going to be featuring for resources and inspiration all of the Daily Good and the different service space and so on as a way to help connect people. So I'm just, what my biggest interest is that we can start, I can contribute a little bit towards people realizing that, or reconnecting to the divine or the sacred or the preciousness, the spirit in nature, so that we can recommit deeply to what it will take to really put, you know, restore our earth and make that a priority.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think everything falls in place around that. And our artistic kind of expression, I feel, is something where we can have meaning without materialism, where we have playfulness and love and creativity in daily life without having to go to the store and buy a bunch of stuff. You know.
Yeah, so, that's an interesting point you make there, and I just want to follow up with something of a paradox that I've bumped into personally. It seems we have more and more stuff,
yeah,
because it makes our life convenient. I'm beginning to suspect that convenience and simplicity are not one and the same thing. What would you say about that?
Mm. Yeah, well, you know what? I think that's a good point, and I think that convenience in quotes might be kind of like the beauty that has been sold to us, you know, like with cosmetics and facelifts and all that kind of fake stuff, that maybe some of things that we were told were convenient, like let's say some food packaged in plastic that you put in a microwave and then you eat it just to fill up, that maybe there's something that you're really missing, that soul connection of the food from the farmer's market or the garden and that simple soup that you created that has so much love in it. that there's some things with convenience that we really are complicating our lives, or the big picture of it is actually causing depletion of our Earth's resources. So I think that's a really important thing to reconsider. And I think that simplicity doesn't have to mean deprivation and self-denial, that it's not one or the other. I think there's an incredible beauty and richness and delight and joyousness with like the handmade life. But I don't mean the handmade life like necessarily like the Amish or like Martha Stewart tries to sell with, you know, like it's all, you need millions of, you know, hundreds of dollars worth of products to kind of create the cookies or something like that. You know, it's just like, well, you know, she sells, I don't know, a million little things and cookie kit. So I think there's selection. You know, there's discernment. But I've really been giving a lot of thought of what creates meaning in our lives. And some of the old-fashioned things like conversations and handwritten notes and you know, talking to neighbors and what reweaves the fabric of our communities. You know, whether our community is our neighborhood and our library and our farmers markets or in our schools and our hospitals, or if our community is all the way around the world. And I have spent a lot of time in the rainforest, and I feel like it's part of our community. And working with Indigenous people, or it's part of my community, even if they're, you know, whatever, thousands of miles away, it doesn't. And certainly with your work here, the service calls, I mean, that's the community is the world. And so how do we have, like, that world view and then that sense of responsibility and richness in our lives? So anyway, convenience sometimes is a product and is a fantasy and is something that... sometimes menial labor, like washing our dishes and weeding our garden and little doing our laundry or ironing or little things that cleaning our house we've considered, you know, not worth great work, but they can give us order and it can give us kind of like a relaxation of the mind. It can be kind of a meditation. That convenience isn't everything.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear this, and certainly inspiring. I know that many people in our lives, you know, here on Service Space, you know, my neighbors next door, we can be so cerebral, and you know, as you say, we're looking for those opportunities to really catch the flashes of the sacred. But when we do get our priorities a little screwed, are there things that you can recommend that allow us to open our hearts, you know, particularly for our folks who work in call centers or emergency rooms or classrooms or things where everything is so overload? How can we find those opportunities or create those opportunities where we can have that ah moment?
Well, I think that it's really sometimes very simple things like silence and breath, awareness of our breath, even for a little while. I mean, hopefully for, you know, 15 minutes a day, or, you know, would be great. But even as pauses, to look out at the sky and deeply breathe. One of my friends, when he'd go into business meetings, if he could just go into the bathroom and wash his hands, like let the water run over his hands and cleanse himself and breathe deeply before he went into the meeting, he'd use that as a simple ritual without having tons of time. And now in his big business meetings, he'll put on his iPhone this little ding bell that dings randomly. And with that just that little bell ring, breathing, just taking a couple of breaths, even in a business meeting. I think that coming home to ourselves, sometimes I know I tend to be way too much in my head, and when I can come home to my body, that's really important. Mm-hmm. So sometimes that's just taking the little time to say your own prayer of gratitude before you eat, and to have at least the first few bites, even if you're rushing and you're at lunch at work or whatever, but just take it, you know, and just be in gratitude and really listen and really taste it, savor. And little, small, even modest practices of savoring, it's like savoring life, you know, looking out at the night sky, you know, breathing and knowing you're breathing within, looking at one flower, having one flower on your desk or by your bed or something, just one thing that is just beauty, lighting a candle just to say one prayer. Something, sometimes very simple actions can bring us home. And we can go on and on with a million ideas for longer practices and retreats and so on. But I think sometimes just creating a little space, intentionality and a little space. It's like that clear part of the desk. And believe me, I suffer with clutter, so I know what that's like. But I think sometimes that is very helpful.
Hmm. Yeah. Elizabeth, in the beginning of the phone call, you did mention that you had some challenges earlier in your life, and as many of us often do. And I'm wondering if you would be willing to share with us how those challenges impacted your outlook on life, how it helped to form you as a person. Would you be willing to share some of that with us?
Yeah. Will, our mom, we had six children in my family, and our mom got cancer when I was 10 years old, and I was the second to the oldest. There was five born in 4 years, and then the sixth. So the youngest was about two, I think. And my dad, you know, started his own business and didn't have insurance and went bankrupt, and kind of like what's happened to a lot of people recently. And so we ended up on welfare, and my dad became an alcoholic, and my mom also had questions with the church, the Catholic Church, and it was all these things about birth control even back then, and she couldn't have any more children, and the doctor said she would die, and then she had mental instability and was taken away in a, you know, to Napa in eighth grade and a straitjacket, and I mean, we had a lot of trauma, and there was a lot of extremes between mental illness and cancer and welfare and dad's drinking and so on, and keeping the family going and keeping what we call keeping the ship, which was our family home, and keeping the kids all together and, you know, raised kind of, and so I was raising each other. And then always I had a real strong belief in spirit and in experimenting lots of different spirituality and the Quakerism, which was meditation, I found when I was 16, and that really was important to me. And service, that was American Friends Service Committee, and starting to work in work camps and build houses in San Joaquin Valley and so on. That was really important to me, and being an exchange student in Japan, and just for a summer because I couldn't be away too long. But and just keeping the family going, and but spirit and things outside ourselves and nature were really important, and community and reaching out to other people, like especially elders. And I was very fortunate to have this mentor, that this woman who was in our Quaker meeting, who just became this really incredible clear light for me. And she died a couple of years ago in her 90s, but she followed me for decades, and we became very, very close together. And she really helped. She was a Jungian psychologist and an astrologer and a world traveler, and had done service after the war in Europe and in Korea with displaced children. And so always, and she knew Joseph Campbell and traveled with him, and she's a mythologist. So this incredible woman who just illuminated a new way of life for me, that you can be of service even if you don't have money yourself. And I would earn money not only for my family, but also to be able to go away to work camps or go away and work in Africa. Or it just, my mom thought it was really strange to work, earn money, to work for free for somebody else. But anyway, that was something, and always my closeness to nature and art and spirit. That was just something that sustained me. And later in life, there's been a lot of deaths in my life, and finally being able to marry my great love, who was my college art teacher. And just a couple of months after we got married, he got brain cancer, and 7.5 months after we married, he died. So most of our marriage was his illness and in and out of hospitals. And that was extremely difficult, to say the least. But it was also an experience of pure love and pure devotion, and reaching beyond what I thought I was capable of. So I think that sometimes difficulties or challenges, they help us stretch our capacity. And also what I feel is, there's a Rumi poem about breaking your heart open, but when our hearts are broken open, and we've all had broken hearts, but one image that came to me was my heart being so broken open, but the little tip of the heart at the bottom was held together, and then the love from Gerald who had died, or other loves of people who had died, or love of the divine, it just was like gold pouring in to this heart that's now the capacity was much greater, and then these flowers could come up from that. So I think that challenge is really tough and it's hard, and we can all wish our lives were different. But on the other hand, it's like plowing those fields. When our hearts get expanded, I think it takes some rigor and some commitment to realign with, instead of getting bitter or angry or, and believe me, I've gone through my times of feeling depressed or sad a great deal, but, and I, again, flowers and nature of my therapy, but I think that there is, we gain a greater capacity, a greater ability, and if we can go into the compassion and empathy instead of judgment or hardness, I think that we can be we can offer more in our lives, and hopefully be kinder to ourselves and to others. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, nearly everybody's lives isn't quite what they wanted or what they imagined. And so part of that being an artist, I think, is like being able to hold that creative tension and being able to be in the mystery. And that's part of the reason to be, in quotes, out of control, because you can't control it anyway. So when, and it's also part of that presence and savoring, because with all these various experiences I've had with death, it gives me more realization that our time is so precious here. And one of the things I love doing, and it's one of my services that I do, is I help people with their funerals, and also I love, weddings and baby blessings. But I actually do flowers. I make a lot of flower arrangements, huge, huge, big flower arrangements for lots and lots of occasions. And but I love making them. I make them often for people who have died, and it's a sacred work for me to make these flowers as offerings. And I think that maybe I've become more comfortable with death, and that has been this deep, it grieves me, and I wish it's been a difficult journey, but it also gives me this vibrancy and this recommitment to life. And this commitment to savoring and, savoring rather than saving, I guess.
That's great. Yeah.
In many ways, I feel like you're, Elizabeth, you're sharing your personal journal with us. It's such a gift.
Thank you. It is a personal, journey, which is what every journal is written about, hopefully.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's part of authenticity, isn't it? And and that's part of not being perfect, is like if we can, and I think there's nothing more precious than being able to share someone's journey authentically. I mean, that's the biggest gift we can give. And hopefully, if it's shared authentically, which would only be humble. And I like that word humble because it goes with humus, which is the soil, and humor and humanity. But I just feel like everything is so humbling. You know, when we are, you know, in our journey, it's, you know, nothing's perfect.
Yeah. I really believe there's no coincidences in life, especially now, because just last night I was at a farewell party and people were asking me why, you know, what inspired me to move to the West Coast. And I was telling everyone that I've always felt so refreshed after I go into nature, but I just didn't realize until I was in nature all the time how vital it is for my creative energy and my well-being. And I was talking about the poetry of John Donahue even, and here I am, like, listening to you, and so much of what you're saying is like, that's exactly how I feel.
Oh, that's so great.
It's really beautiful. Thank you. Just wanted to share that. And I think we have a question.
Hi, this is Pallavi calling from San Jose. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for everything you've shared. And what I want to ask you is, you know, I'm going through an intense transformation in my life, and I can see this is going to be life-changing. And the thing I'm grappling with is the, you know, the inner voice and the mystery is getting louder and louder. But then my rational mind and my the cerebral part of myself, you know, is not fully letting go and freaked out. And so I'm trying to figure out, you know, I have a feeling, you know, like you said, your heart breaks open and more beauty flows in. And I have a feeling this is some kind of an experience like that. But my rational mind is still holding on. So I wanted to know what you could say about trusting the inner voice.
Thank you. That's a great, great question. You know, sometimes what I do is I do different kinds of ways of what I call divination that helps me reinforce or get more information about something. I think that right now, today, in this, you know, whatever we want to call it, this new millennium or whatever, it is, this is our work to go more into the intuition and more connected with heart. And so bless you for, you know, going on this journey. So sometimes when I need extra guidance or extra, I will tell you a few tools I do.
Ah, wonderful.
A simple one, you know, this, it may or may not work for you, but a simple one is sometimes I use a little pendulum, and I have the ring that was my husband's wedding ring on a gold chain, and I just ask a yes or a no and have it go back and forth. I might do that. I wouldn't. I might do the thing that I get. Sometimes I do tarot cards. Angela Sarian's my teacher. I use her kind. But the most incredible that has helped me is something I came to myself, but I'll ask a question writing down with my dominant hand. I'm a right-handed person, so I'll write down the question with my right hand, and then with my left hand, my non-dominant hand, I'll answer the question. And the handwriting is messy. And this,
wow!
And what I came across this at on the anniversary of Gerald's death. He had died it had been 5 years, and it was in the mission in Carmel with a sacred music and candlelight. And I thought, this is, we had listened to this kind of music together. And I just said, you know, dear Gerald, I'm thinking of you. Do you have any guidance for me at this time? And then I answered, and I didn't know why I did this. I just did it. I got a few sentences that were so comforting, so profound, so dear, that I started doing it as a practice, and I've done it now for 13 years. Now I write pages, and I don't just ask Gerald, I ask other guides, or I ask my higher self, and it, when I'm stuck on a book, or when I'm stuck on a path in my life, or I need, please give me insight into the situation, and it is profound for me. And I don't overuse it. I don't, you know, and it does take a little practice. And I usually set up, I try to set up some clarity and sacred space around it, like lighting a candle, sitting silently for a little while, you know, and not just running from one thing to another, but giving it. So I would really recommend that, and it's you know, and it, you can direct it to someone who is your guide, mother or dad, or your God, or your angels, or whoever, your higher self, and just try it, and it's and I also think that when we're going from very cerebral kind of controlled, I think it's also a good practice to try to be more in our bodies, a yoga practice, you know, some kind of movement practice. And I also think that walking in nature is really important, where we are aware of our walking, you know, and placing ourselves on the earth and our breath.
Yes, yes.
Just like coming home to ourselves and something that brings our heart open. So that might be a walk on the beach or in the woods or silence in a garden or something like that, or weeding, just simple, you know. But those are things that have helped me.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. This is wonderful.
Yeah, good for you.
Thank
for
you.
Blessings to you.
Elizabeth, you have done a number of trips. I think they were multiple trips that maybe I misunderstood you in our conversation, to the Galapagos Islands, to the Andes. Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, mostly to the jungle. Yeah, the jungle
okay.
and the Andes.
But you also spoke about some projects that you got involved there as well. I'm wondering if you could tell our callers about that.
Yeah, since childhood I wanted to go to the Amazon, and through a good friend of mine, I met her good friend, Lynn Twist, who started the Pachamama Alliance. And Pachamama means Mother Earth and the whole cosmos and all of creation. It's a Quechuan word from the Andes. And so I was able about 12 years ago to go to the jungle, the Amazon jungle in Ecuador, with Lynn and her husband, Bill Twist. And I just was so inspired by the Ashuar people, and I ended up becoming a leader and bringing people down there and helping them. They wanted to write their language and helping them make the first book in their own language, and bringing down art supplies and teaching the youth how to paint so they could paint their illustrations for this myth that we published and sent down there. And also I'm anyone on the service call that would like one of these books and wants to give to their libraries or schools, I'd be happy to send them out. But so my life has really been enriched and enlarged by being in the honor of these indigenous people, the Ashuar, and they are a dream culture that wake up early in the morning and tell their family their dreams, and that's how they plan their day. Mm-hmm. And then every once in a while they decide they need a community dream, and they come together as a community, and with their shaman leading them, often taking a plant medicine that gets them more aligned with the bigger forces, they get in tune to what their whole community needs to do. And so about 15 years ago, they had a community dream that instructed them that they no longer could be the warriors to keep everybody out of their jungle. What they needed to do is to invite people of heart into their jungle, into their forest. And they realized that they were the protectors of the lungs of the earth. Mm. So this is really remarkable. And I was... So the Twists went, and then I was invited to go, and it is just a profound honor to be in a place where nature is foremost and that trees are honored like people. And so this was a big shift for me to feel that vibration and my heart. I mean, I just like cried because I was so touched. And then by working with the youth and making this book, that was incredible because the youth were like, they never used watercolors or art supplies before, but they're immediately great artists because they're so observant and they know their place. And so I also working with them and working with the Pachamama Alliance as a volunteer, it awakened me to all our connections and another way of thinking of all our relationships and how our lifestyle and our Western world can really impact theirs in their jungle life. Anyway, so that's been this wonderful. It's interesting to go from my great love of France and Monet's garden and the very cultivated to something that is so wild. And just last week I was in the Galapagos, and that was my first time there. But again, this gift of being with animals that have no fear and that you can just come right up to them and they swim with you, the seals or sea lions and the iguanas and so on. So that's just this heart-opening feeling for me. Just a great, great experience.
And that book again that you created, what was it called?
Oh, it's called, it's a name of a myth, and it's Natu and Ahu, How the Moon and the Putu Bird Came to Be. And I have them, and I was selling them, and then the money goes back to Pachamama. Or now I just really want to get them out in the world. And I've used them to teach in Salinas. We had 50 teachers, and they were bilingual teachers, and teaching them how to teach about the rainforest or myth or connectivity or beauty or dreams. But now I really want to offer them to anyone to bring, and they're trilingual, so they're in Oshawa language, Spanish, and English. And they're beautiful. They're little hardback books that are made with these beautiful illustrations of the youth, from the youth.
And people can contact you directly for these books?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let me just give folks your website, because I don't know if they may have caught it on the screen. It's Elizabeth, with a Z, ElizabethMurray.com, correct?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, so those
Thank
are
you.
Available. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I'd love to just spread them out. I'd like to mention, if I could, that I'm teaching different workshops, and I'm teaching a four-weekend one that is going to be on this new book, Living Life in Full Bloom. The book comes out in January 2014. I'm supposed to be finished with it in 6 weeks, so I'm working hard on it. But I'm going to be teaching each weekend here at my house, and I have an old, wonderful historic house in Monterey and a big garden. So one weekend will be around the gardener, another weekend around the artist, another for the lover, and the last one will be spirit weaver, and we'll do creating blessings and rituals and all kinds of, it'll be fun and it will be of depth. So people can find out about that as well.
On the website as well. Mm-hmm. I noticed that you also do consulting for people. You do these workshops. I imagine people are writing to you about their experiences and how you perhaps have touched their lives. Are there any stories that you can share with us about things that people have said to you that either touched you deeply and thought, oh, wow, isn't that amazing? Or maybe somebody who said, you know, gee, Elizabeth, if it weren't for you, I never would have, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Any stories along those lines that came out of your connections with others?
Well, yesterday I actually got an email from a woman who was the director of the Arts and Crafts Museum in San Francisco, and she makes little boxes with sacred space or talismans, or and she just emailed me saying, you know, I got your book, Cultivating Sacred Space, years ago, and I liked it. But just yesterday, I took it off the bookshelf, and I said, oh, my God, this is just perfect for me. This is so helpful. I just can't. And then so she was inquiring about classes and so on. But for me to get that yesterday was such an affirmation, because I was working on designing this four-weekend workshop, and I normally never teach for 4 weekends. I only do it far less than that. So I thought, oh, this is a real affirmation. And I think, of course, millions of stories about Monet and following your bliss and gardens as art and then gardens of sacred space. I've had a lot of stories. And I think one thing that is probably of the most touching or more depth is people who have lost their husbands and or their spouses and have been in great grief, or even lost another loving member of the family or a child, and they found my book or my writing about loss and the idea of life, death, life, and the continuum of love and relationship even after death, that they've found that to be really helpful or comforting or healing or inspiring. Mm-hmm. And I think that that has touched me a great deal. And I think when I have lectured, I've done a lot of lecturing around the country, and when I've lectured and I've had a lot of especially young women who've come up to me and said, oh, I can't believe you quit your job and you went and did what you loved, and that's incredible, and it changed your whole life. And so I have a lot of young women who I love, and some I've kind of adopted to be what we call spirit daughters. So that inspiration of people to really follow what they love, those stories from them, that has been great for me, has had a lot of meaning for me.
That's wonderful.
Wow, I'm just blown away, and I actually can't wait to listen to the recording of this call because I feel that there's just so many gems in what you've shared, and I really want to, well, actually, it seems that we have a question. I think we have time for one more question.
Hello, my name's Mary Jo.
Hi, thanks for joining.
Elizabeth, you've been a big inspiration to me in so many ways for so many years.
Really?
And what I'm curious, really, very much so, ever since I read about you in Victoria Magazine, that I spent years trying to find your book and years trying to find a camera, and just so many, many great, wonderful things came out of reading your work. I really wouldn't have time to explain them here, but it's been a big blessing for my life. Mm. And I'm just curious about your daily and your weekly, your own individual process of how you work. Like I do morning pages and I sometimes draw, but I'm always fascinated by seeing how others come into their own on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it depends on the project I'm on. And right now I'm writing my book, you know. And so I have to make myself really disciplined, which isn't an ordinary state of mind for me. But I love what my teacher, Angel Sarian, says, discipline is to be thy own disciple. So I was like, okay.
Mm.
And so I am getting up at 5:45 and sometimes earlier, and I, you know, do meditation. I do my yoga. I'm in a class with a group at 7 a.m. I have a little puppy I take care of, and then I have to get to work. And sometimes I do, you know, something else. But and so I try, and I really try to be disciplined. And break times for me are weeding or making soup. I love making soup, and I make soup with great love, and I give it away, and I freeze it, and I use it for when I don't have time. And soup is a metaphor and I have to write like soup, you know. Sometimes it's chop, 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 cut, 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 stir, stir, stir. And then other times it's savor and time and retaste and readjust, and it's not done yet. And sometimes if I have like an art show, a big art show, whether it's photography or like last year was a big art show at New York Botanical, that stretches me. Oh my God, the computer skills and this and that. That is really, some things are really hard for me, and then I have to call in help. Sometimes I have to be aware of really keeping in sufficiency, so I don't. Some things can make me feel like, oh, I'm not good at this. Oh, I can't do this. You know, everything disappeared on the computer. Or so I have to have more time in nature. I have to breathe. I have to be in my body. I have to, you know, like that. I love the play. I love the create. You know, just creating. Sometimes if it's too much about words, like if it's writing, I love handwriting. But if it's like writing on the computer, I have to do something messy with my hands, get dirty, you know, be in the garden, make the soup, play with the dog. Something that I'm not, just being on the computer is not enough for me. So it's like that. And if it's a painting, it's opening, and I'm going to do painting. There's a certain discipline in that, in getting there. And there's that certain way of talking myself into something, because there's that joyous start, and then there's in the middle going, this is hard, or I'm not good anymore, or I lost it, or how could I ever do this, or what was I thinking? Were those kind of questions, you know, like, oh, my God. And so how to change that kind of way into completion, and that little hump, and it can even be like I'm making all the flowers for a bride's wedding or a big funeral, and in the middle I'm going, this isn't very good. What am I doing? and all of a sudden you have to like go over that hump. And so is it through prayer? Is it through a little, I love you, I believe in you, you can do this, or this is great, or just breathe, or let's have a cup of tea, or whatever it is to try to get over that, and a piece of chocolate, walking away for a little while, coming back with fresh eyes. And it's, to me, I think there's a big difference between exploration and play, which I really love, and I think we need to do a lot of. And I love writing in a journal, and I love I love researching, and also in completion for a specific goal. And completion for a specific goal, an art show, a book, whatever, a course, that takes that much more discipline to have it cooked, you know, to have it done, to have it presentable. And it takes that much letting go. This is enough. This is enough. I am enough. This and also willingness to say, you know, like, those are all done, but you know what? I can go back and adjust that. I can go back and make that just a little bit better. And that's not about control and perfection, but it's about, okay, that soup does need a little more salt and pepper or whatever. It's sometimes we do have to go back in, and being willing to do that, and then being willing to let it go, and this is enough. And the bride is about to walk down the aisle. Your flowers look fine. Let's go. You know, like that. So it's that adjusting, but, and I think that part of staying in the body as much as possible and not just being in the head is really important. And, you know, dance, music, yoga, gardening, you know, that helps.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome.
And Elizabeth, we would like to ask, you know, thank you so much for your time and for sharing so many beautiful gems. And what can we do for you? How can we further your journey in service and in life?
Well, thank you. Well, I think you are. You are right now just just to invite me to share is a great honor, and thank you. And
I
hope that when my book is finished, that maybe I can talk about it again, and that I can make some time to be to contribute to your service.
You already have.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.